begin speaking about the precepts now and talk specifically on sila and what that means in terms of the precepts. I'd like to start with, in the Samyutta Nikaya, one of the ancient texts where the Buddha's words and teachings were recorded, there was this said about sila, and which is translated as virtue here. So someone approached the Buddha and asked the Buddha this: let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma, or the Dharma in brief. And the Buddha answered to this bhikkhu, this monk, well then, bhikkhu, purify the very starting point of wholesome states. And what is the starting point of wholesome states? Virtue that is well purified and view that is straight. Then when your virtue is well purified and your view straight, based upon virtue, established upon virtue, you should then develop the four establishments of mindfulness. So one thing that is being pointed out here is that the Buddha often talked about really establishing the precepts in one's life even before beginning to meditate. So the practice of the precepts is a very foundational practice in the Dhamma. And it's important to see where it comes in terms of in relationship to practicing meditation. And I believe that we can do them both at the same time, but in some ways I'm not sure whether there's been enough energy put into the value of precepts, the value of the commitment to non-harming. And so this is what I wanted to put a light on this afternoon. When we practice virtuous conduct or practice non-harming, the precepts, this overcomes transgressive behavior. This is behavior that is acted out in our actions, in our speech. It's when maybe an unwholesome mood or thought has affected the mind, and then immediately afterwards the speech takes over and carries that out into the world or to the person right next to us, or in our behavior. The second training, it's helpful if you sit up. Thank you. Are you in pain? Oh, okay. Then it's okay to lay down. Yeah. The second training after the training of sila is the training in calming the mind or concentrating the mind. And this overcomes the obsessiveness of the mind. As you know, when we sit and we meditate, we see how the mind is going off in different directions, thinking and getting identified with the thoughts. And we come back to the breath over and over again to help stabilize the attention or come back to the body. And then when we get stabilized enough, or maybe we're able to see the thinking process without getting identified with it, so we can note or notice it. And the mind can still feel stabilized even when there's plenty of thinking going on. So the second training after the training in sila is a training in calming the mind or concentrating the mind. This is overcoming the obsessiveness of the mind. With these two as a platform, then the training in wisdom can begin. Because the mind is more calm, because it's not caught up in reviewing the past, rehashing the past, in regretting or feeling guilty. It doesn't have any of that that it goes through. It is able to be like a calm pool, a pool in which maybe you can look into the pool and see deeply to the different layers. In this third training of the training in wisdom, overcoming the latent or dormant defilements of the mind, it overcomes them because it sees clearly the different layers of the mind without getting identified with them. It begins to see everything as impermanent, impersonal, and nothing to hang on to, even the pleasant experiences. So these are the three trainings, and I wanted you to see where virtuous conduct or sila is in relationship to all of that. It's the very first one. It's the very basic one. It's the very most fundamental one, but one that we should never lose sight of. It's the one that everything else is built upon. And it's important to see the value of it in terms of the Dharma, in terms of our practice. It was out of compassion that the Buddha offered these trainings of the five precepts. The five precepts are refraining from killing or harming any living being. Refraining from stealing is the second one, taking what isn't offered. And I'll review these in more detail later. Refraining from sexual misconduct is the third. And the fourth one is refraining from untruthfulness, which is in its own right, it is one of the paramis, and I'll expand on that one. And then the fifth one is refraining from ingesting any intoxicants that make the mind fuzzy, that make the mind unclear, that cloud the mind. So it was out of compassion that the Buddha offered these five precepts, out of knowing, being a human being, knowing the trouble that can come, knowing the confusion and the disturbance in the mind of oneself and the mind of others that can come when these are acted out. The precepts are not commandments. They're trainings. They're a commitment to the training. And the training means that we're not always going to be able to do them. That's why we take the training over and over again. Sometimes we, you know, when we're in retreat, we take the precepts every day in some retreats. Some people take the precepts every day, even out of retreat, just to remind oneself the importance of that kind of a training. In the training, and this is the way one of our teachers, my main teacher, Sayadaw Upandita, reflects on the training. I will take great care to refrain from killing any living being. I will take great care to refrain from taking what is not offered. I will take great care in refraining from any sexual misconduct. So it's with that kind of commitment, with that kind of way that we say it to ourselves. It's not with that I will not do this ever again and somebody else is kind of forcing the commandment on me. It's a training, it's a commitment that we take ourselves because we know it's leading to happiness. It's for not just for oneself, but of course for others. When we look at how the precepts are worded, we see that it's worded in terms of renunciation. I will take great care to refrain. It's a beautiful form of renunciation. To refrain from doing things that harm, saying things that harm. So when it gets right down to it, it's relinquishing greed, hatred, and delusion. We can see that in the different precepts that we take, I will take great care to refrain from killing any living being or harming even any living being. That has to do with relinquishing hatred or aversion. I will take great care to refrain from sexual misconduct. That has to do with relinquishing greed or desire, that kind of harmful desire that can harm another, harm oneself also. And for example, on the last one, I will take great care to refrain from ingesting anything that will cloud the mind. That's relinquishing delusion. So with each one of the precepts, and you can test for yourself, see for yourself what you're letting go of is not just that action or not just those words, but really letting go on a deeper level of the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's also the cultivation of compassion. We can see that as we carry out the precepts. We're not only developing renunciation, but we're developing compassion for others because of the non-harming, and compassion for ourselves because we see how difficult it is to feel that troubled nature within when we do those things. When there is this letting go, this kind of renunciation of greed and hatred and delusion, then the clarity of wisdom can arise. Generosity can arise. Goodwill or metta can arise. It has room for all of that. This is a very fertile soil for deepening, ever-deepening wisdom, the insights that bring us to liberation, for all of these wonderful, deep, profound experiences to come. And it happens because the mind is clear. The mind is clean. When I went to my teacher one of the last times I went to practice in Burma, he asked me what I was doing. Why am I here? He said, why are you here? And he had previously advised me that I could just continue to practice at home. But I love to go to Burma, and I love to be there and be in the, under that guidance and protection of all the other yogis and the wonderful teachers that are there and the land. And I said, I want to clean my mind more because I could see it isn't exactly pure. And I know that by doing more practice on that level, I can see deeper places where it gets caught, especially places of delusion. So there's moments when we feel that unviolable protection of purity in the mind when we're really practicing sila. I think it can't be, we can't put even enough light on it in this world. We really need to put even more attention than we actually give it in our practice. A great trust comes up in oneself, and this brings a lot of confidence in our practice. A lot of times when I go and visit my teachers in Asia or my senior colleagues here that live in the West, even if I'm not bowing to them outright, I know in Burma it's easy to bow to my teachers there, the sayadaws, the monks. But there are wonderful people like Joseph Goldstein and even yogis around that I feel like, you know, I would like to bow to them. I'd like to get on my knees and give them a bow for all of the work they've done to purify their minds. Because I don't see as much, or I see a lessening of the acting out of greed and hatred in the mind, and how much clearer their mind becomes because of that. It's really beautiful. It's really wonderful. It's one of the great beauties of the world that I take notice of. This sila is characterized as composing oneself. And you really feel that when there is sila in one's mind, in oneself, or the mind of another. You can feel a deep composure when the mind isn't kind of wafting here and there because of guilt or resentment or even remorse, which is a good thing to have. but we can settle in something beyond that. It said that the function of sila is to abstain from conduct that leads to disharmony. That's its function. It achieves the quality of blamelessness. All of this characteristic function and what it achieves comes from the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification. It said that the dangers of committing harmful actions through our speech, through our behavior, is that we will be plagued by self-criticism, self-blame, criticizing and blame from others also, and remorse and regret. And of course, I've just said that these can be good things, remorse and regret, but they still make the mind ruffled. It's not like we have a very feeling of settledness in the mind when those are there. Another danger is we risk losing the trust of others, especially the wise and the virtuous that we treasure. These are exactly the words from the Visuddhimagga. We risk losing the trust, especially the wise and the virtuous that we treasure. And as I mentioned earlier, it's been really important to me to, you know, what would it be if I had to face those people that I trust, that are wise and virtuous, if they knew that any of these precepts were gravely broken. And of course, the karma of it is enduring future difficulties, being born in what is called states of loss. That's kind of an interesting way that it's put, states of loss. That means one's mental states are rough and intractable, dense and painful. It doesn't even mean that one's in a hell realm, in some physical hell realm someplace else. It's the present state of mind that is the hell realm that we're in. So when there's an inner state of blamelessness, the mind is very calm. It has an effect on the mind that allows it to open, allows it to feel safe because there's less agitation, allows it to understand deeply the true nature of reality. Sila is the foundation for samadhi, for a calm mind. Samadhi is the foundation for wisdom, for the insights into the true nature of reality to arise. So, I want to go into the various ones now. The first precept is to refrain. I will take great care to refrain from harming any living being. And that's to refrain from killing, of course. We become sensitized to the fact that this means, not harming any human beings. But when we get really sensitive in the Dharma, in our practice, we start seeing how careful the mind is in response to any living being. You might see in yourself the carefulness when you're a yogi, for example. How many of you have been at Cloud Mountain Retreat Center? A lot of you. And when you come across one of those great, big, beautiful, yet a little bit slimy slug, and your foot is just about to go on it, maybe you turn your foot because of aversion, but you might also turn your foot because of care, because you don't want to kill, you don't want to harm. And that would be good to notice in yourself, if that's coming from an aversion or coming from a real deep caring for that sentient being. That being has, wants to be happy also. That's kind of one of the reflections that we have. Even this being wants to be happy in its own way. I remember His Holiness the Dalai Lama telling a story once of how he became more sensitized to that precept in relationship to mosquitoes. That, it, you know, where he lives in India, and when he travels around, of course, in India, there are plenty of mosquitoes. And at first, he told a story of like this, that at first the mosquito would land on him, and just out of habit, he would raise his hand and, you know, just out of habit. But the more that he became sensitized to non-harming and the precepts, he would raise his hand but not kill the mosquito. It would be just, or brushing the mosquito away lightly. And then after a while, even becoming more sensitized to that, he would see the mosquito there and let the mosquito have a meal. And say, may you be happy. May you be happy. After all, what comes from that little bite is just a little bump that goes away quickly. In many cases, of course, I've just been learning about malaria and dengue fever and getting all the shots because I'm on my way to Burma after this. But really, just getting so caring that you recognize that caring in yourself. And it's a great sense of confidence and trust that you have in that you can really develop beautiful qualities of mind that can help you deepen in your practice. So we can see how it is for us when we come to this precept of non-harming. How far do we take it? It's not about self-blame or whether you're good or bad. It's just about how sensitive you can get to the happiness of another being. Can you recognize that in any being, no matter how small? See how it works for you as you go out into your life, and maybe you see if you're taking these precepts more seriously and how it works for you. And the second one is refraining from taking what hasn't been offered. And I can imagine that no one in this room steals things. It's not that, you know, we were thinking about robbing the next bank, you know, the moment we leave. But how can we become more refined with that is always a question that I ask myself with these precepts. How can I become more refined in that particular precept? So one way that I might look at it, for example, is when I'm in a retreat or even just here, I saw a package of cough lozenges on the table, and I was about to take it, and actually I picked it up in my hands, and then I asked someone, is this something that I can take? I didn't just assume that it was there for everyone. Maybe somebody had left it. So really being careful about things like that, seeing how you could get more refined about taking what is not been offered. One time, it was really sensitive reflection that someone had, I thought. I was at a retreat at Spirit Rock, and it was a people of color retreat, and very sensitive people in the group. And someone came up to me and said, you know, when you said this, I thought you meant that. Did you mean that? And it was something that would have caused hurt to that person. And I said, no, I didn't mean that. And she said, I'm so glad that I was following the precepts because I realized that I might be taking something that was not offered. And that was so beautiful to me. Because she didn't know whether I was really offering that. It was just kind of a translation on her part that she wasn't sure about. So she took it in a way that was so, so deep that I could never even think of myself. So taking refraining from taking what has not been offered. So how would we play that out a little more? I'm going to leave some time at the end for us to talk about this, to see how what we can do. And so just one more example of that, just to kind of give you places to springboard from. When I do my walk on Maui, there are lots of gardens, and there are lots of, as there are here, of course, and there are lots of trees with avocados and hanging over on the street and papayas. I'm not to make you wanting to go there, but maybe someday, you know. And trees with fruit hanging over on the street. And one day I was passing by with one of my other Dharma girlfriends, and we were wondering whether, is it stealing to take that fruit? Because it's hanging over the street, and besides that, you know, some are on the street. And so we really had to talk about it. Like, does this, because even this one that's avocado that's fallen on the street, would that be stealing? Would that be? And then we just realized we're not going to take a chance because it's our karma that's involved. When you put karma and avocado, I mean, duh, you know, I don't have to be a Dharma teacher to know that, to make that. I pick clean karma, not the avocado. So it's really being refined in our understanding of the precepts and getting more and more refined as we go along. So what about refraining from taking part in sexual energy that can hurt someone? So that just doesn't mean that person that we're having the experience with, but it can mean someone else that that person's connected to. Or it can mean, say, I have a partner and I'm having, you know, connection, intimate connection with someone else, that could hurt my partner. And so even that kind of valuing that kind of sensitivity, how that kind of sexual energy, even if it's not that intimate, that kind of energy that's trying to connect with someone else, how could that hurt my partner or that person if that person has a partner? Just seeing how that could play out in ways that would cause disharmony in the family, in relationships, how could that cause hurt? So that's the third one. And then the fourth one I'm going to leave for last, because that has to do with truthfulness, refraining from speaking a lie or an untruth. And the fifth one has to do with refraining from ingesting anything that will cause unclarity in the mind, or cause the mind to be in different levels or degrees of delusion. And I think if you talk to a monk or a teacher, a sayadaw, at least our sayadaws in Burma, they take it to this degree that even if somebody were holding you on the ground, holding your arms and legs down and opening your mouth and pouring whatever it is in your mouth that would cause, you know, your mind to be deluded or not to be clear, you wouldn't swallow it. You would spit it out, even to that degree. But there are plenty of other Dharma teachers who have a wide range of interpretation of that. And I think it's not that anybody has to be over us and make it some kind of a commandment, or this thou shalt not do this or that, but it's that each one of us for ourselves has to see what causes the mind to be unclear, deluded, not really noticing what's going on very clearly. And, you know, it's not that I want to make this some kind of place that you have to jump off from or compare yourself to me, but I just see more and more how sensitive I've gotten to anything with alcohol in it. Anything with alcohol. I mean, even I've gotten sensitive to chocolate. That's why I told Rich to hold that chocolate that we bought this afternoon. Because it ruffles the mind. It makes the mind unclear through ruffling the mind. Things like chocolate and tea and coffee, which I, in retreat, I have to cut out more and more and more. But as far as anything with alcohol in it, I can see the next morning when I go to sit the next morning, boy, everything is so fuzzy for me. Maybe not for someone else, but for me. So I've really just had to be very, very careful how much I ingest. And I still have not even a glass of wine, but a few gulps of wine now and then in social gatherings and sometimes just because it's a wonderful thing to do with when you go out to dinner, especially because we were just in Italy and had that. In Italy, by the way, this is a little bit of a transgression, but maybe it will invite you to come to Italy to do that retreat next year. Is it next year? Next year is that they serve wine at the table. You know, we get... Well, you didn't have it because we stopped them from serving the wine. But they'll serve wine at lunchtime and at dinner. And they were completely shocked that we said, no, no wine, you know. But we served it at the first meal. Yogis could have it the first meal and the last meal. Because it really does kind of do a little bit of a trick on your mind. So where are you with that? You know, can you really look at how it is for you? Do you really care? And it's not a matter of that anybody's going to grade you. You know, you can keep it to yourself. It's just that you're looking to see what it is for yourself that makes you the most clear and the most clean of aversion and greed. And go from there. And as you go along with practicing the precepts, you may refine them in your own way. You don't have to talk to anybody about it, but in your own way, you're going to refine them. So now I want to go back to talking about the fourth precept, refraining from saying what is untruthful. It said that the bodhisattvas of all time who became Buddhas, and there have been many Buddhas in the world cycles of the world cycles. This Buddha that has lived in our age, which we are still receiving teachings from, is probably... I got a book when I was in Burma that talked about the 24 Buddhas of the different life cycles, different world cycles. And so at least it goes way, way back. When these human beings were becoming Buddhas, they were called bodhisattvas. And the bodhisattvas, while they were becoming Buddhas, they practiced for many lifetimes. It's said, it may be a legendary thing, but... like Manindra says, you don't have to believe it, but it's true, that they practiced and perfected all of these paramis so that when they were able to expound on the Dharma, they expounded it from a very clean and clear heart, and that they could help many beings because they understood the difficulties that beings went through because of their perfecting these paramis through the countless lifetimes that they went through to perfect them. They were, of all the five precepts, it said that the bodhisattvas broke all the precepts, even killing, sexual misconduct, stealing, ingesting things that would cloud the mind, all of those four they would break over and over again. But never once could they break the precept of refraining from lying. That was extremely important. Because it is said that one who is opening the truth has to really stand on the truth, has to really live in a way of speaking truthfully in order to be able to open to that profound truth of seeing how it is at all levels. When I went to my first long retreat was a retreat I did in Australia. It was actually Manindra who advised me to take my first long retreat with Sayadaw Upandita in Australia. That was in 1985. And when I went there, it was far away from home, and a month of being in retreat was the longest I'd done was up to that point was 10 days. It was very difficult, and the teacher was very, very strict. I had been warned about that, but I was willing to, as I said, I had been practicing already for about 10 years. My hair was on fire with the Dharma. So I was just really, okay, I'm going to go for it. And I was ready for this teacher's sternness and strictness and ability to give just straightforward direction. So in the first couple of 3 days, there were group interviews. And in the group, we had to tell what our experience was. So I was in a group of maybe 10 or 12 people. And people were saying that their experience was that they could sit and be with their breath continuously for a long time. And then the teacher would ask for how long. And they would give these answers that it was unbelievable to me. I had been practicing for a long time already, and I thought, how could they do it that long? You know, like they would say, oh, half an hour, or the whole sitting, or something. I thought, this was exaggerating, or maybe it's really true, I'm in the wrong group. You know. And then they would talk about being able to experience these incredible moments of bliss for a long, long time, etc., etc. And so the teacher would ask these questions and really get more details, and it was very, you know, I wasn't very confident about myself during that time. When it came my turn, I said, well, I really can't be with the breath very long. There's a lot of restlessness. And I was just talking about how there were the hindrances going on. There was sleepiness, and then there was a lot of doubt. I doubt that I could do this practice with everybody here. And I just felt like a complete failure, you know. So I left that group interview. And then in the Dharma talk, either that evening or the next evening, Sayadaw Upandita was saying in the Dharma talk how the quality of truth is so important in your practice. And that here we're practicing in order to know the truth of reality, of how things are. And in order to know the truth, you have to speak the truth. And then he said, as he usually does, some people, he always starts it out with, some people are saying this and that, and he repeated it. And he said, please check to see that it is really the truth. If it is not the truth, I would like you to line up at my door and tell me that you have not been telling the truth. And I'd like you to ask for forgiveness, because that is the way that your heart can be more rectified. Not because he needed that, but because the students needed that. So I was really relieved that I didn't exaggerate anything. That I just told it like it is, like it was. And so that next morning, That's when he said it was the next day, because that was the evening. I saw people lining up. And I was so relieved that I did not have to line up at the door to say, please forgive me, or to say that I lied, or whatever. So he calls you on it. And even when I've been behind a yogi that hasn't been really clear, that might be, I don't know. It's the thing about not taking what is not offered again. But I don't know what's really going on. But when a yogi in front of me would say something, because we'd hear the interview of the yogi before us, and I would say a Dao or hear him go, huh? You know, like that, like. And then I would hear the yogi getting more refined and detailed in their explanation of what really, really happened. So from that time on, I thought, I have to be really, really clear. And in the reports to this particular teacher, you don't report details like what went on before or after. You're just saying, when there was the rising of the abdomen, this is what was noted and this is what was noticed. And you have to be really clear on what's... So you got to pay a lot of attention, and you have to be very truthful in what's happening. And then you have to express and articulate about what the secondary objects were. Primary is the breath, secondary objects, or anything else that arise. And be very, very detailed and precise and clear about what's going on there. So it makes you really look. It makes you really pay attention to what's going on. So I started to report, and then sometimes I would report that during yesterday, because we reported every day, I sat so many hours and I walked so many hours. And so I was getting the feedback from him that that wasn't precise enough. So I started to check, like when I would sit, sometimes I'd sit a little bit shorter or a little bit longer, and I'd report, I sat yesterday 8 hours and 43 minutes. And I walked 6 hours and 16 minutes. And Sayadaw would say, okay. You know, be that detailed, be that refined. So I don't require anybody to do that, as you know. So, but that's how powerful truthfulness is. That's how powerful that degree of satya, of truthfulness, has to be in our seeing clearly how things are. So those are the five precepts, and what I'm trying to point out here is how they're so important, how powerful they can be in seeing clearly. The benefit that can come from that is that we can feel really confident in ourselves. We can trust ourselves, and other people can trust us too. These are the benefits of virtue. One who is virtuous comes into a large fortune. That doesn't mean that you win the sweepstakes. A large fortune means that you win the Dharma. Your fair name is spread. Now just think of the people that we know that are virtuous. Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Mother Teresa and all those beautiful people. People that I know, you know, like Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, other people. You can say them yourselves. So their fair name is spread, and one enters an assembly without fear. Isn't that nice? Wouldn't that be wonderful? It is wonderful for probably all of you. One dies unconfused. At the breakup of the body, one reappears in a happy destiny, wherever that may be, if you believe in rebirth. Or like Manindra says, even if you don't, it's true.